Venerable Robina is here. If we can stand to welcome her.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Venerable.
I'm here, Andre. You can't see me. Andre, I'm here. Andre.
He's having audio problems, Venerable.
Can we help him?
I'm not sure how to.
Andre, can you hear me? He can't hear me. What's his problem?
I'm not sure, Venerable Rubina.
But has somebody been trying to help him?
Yes.
Okay. Is John Landau there? Is John John Castello there? Can he help him?
John is here. I don't know if he can help him.
Can you please ask him to help Andre? If you can hear me, John, can you please help Andre? Can you hear me, John?
Yes, Venerable, I'll try.
Try and help Andre, okay?
I'll contact
him. Good, thank you. All right. Okay. So here we are again, still alive. How amazing. Our petrol tank immorality, our gas tank immorality has run out. And of course, we never think of it like that. We just think, you know, but we're not. Every second we're still alive is our, still our past virtue has to finish yet, which is pretty incredible. So when we think that, then we think, my goodness, we mustn't waste it. We must make the most of today. So let's do that. What's happening here, Donna?
Trying to share the screen with the prayers and it's going to the wrong place.
Okay.
Technical difficulties, the theme of the day.
Does Don Ray know you're there to help him?
I'm messaging to him right now.
I don't know whether he's going to pay attention. You can't call him on the phone, please?
Yes, I'll try that too.
Good, do that, yeah. What's happened, Don? Oh, I'll just sing the prayers, don't worry, we'll just think it.
Thank you.
Let's just think it, okay? So we just think, because anyone is what to think. So we're thinking the first prayer, we're just going to think, those of us who already figure we're Buddhists, we're going to just thinking we're so happy to have the Buddha and his teachings and we're going to continue to rely upon them so we can get enlightened. And the second two lines are just thinking we're going to listen to these teachings so we can get some tools, so we can develop our amazing potential, so we can help others. Thinking this way, this is why we're together. So reiterating that kind of aspiration. Okay. Sanghe charam soke tom nam la jan cho ba du dak ni kyap su chi da gi chen yen gi pe sonam ki dro la pen chi sanghe drop pa shok sanghe charam soke tom nam la jan cho ba du dak ni kyap su chi da gi chen yen gi pe sonam ki dro la pen chi sanghe drop pa shok sanghe charam soke tom nam la jan cho ba du dak ni kyap su chi Dagi chonyen gipa sonam ki, drola penche sangi drupa shok. Okay. So, yeah. So sometimes we've been talking about looking at the idea of compassion, and really the main one, we're looking at, if we look at the big picture, we see it's not so easy to have such compassion for everybody all the time, obviously, because we haven't done enough of wisdom wing. This is the difference between us and the body sufferers. And if we understand it kind of technically, well, we know the work we'll have to do, you know? So we think of His Holiness, you know, who's said to be a completely enlightened Buddha. But I mean, it's sort of fairly evident if we look at him, if he is the fruit of all this hard work, if he is like the proof of the pudding, you know, if you like music and then you go to a concert and you hear this amazing person play, you go, wow, that's what it's like. And then you get encouragement. Wow, if he can do it, I can do it too, you know? And that's the way to look at someone like His Holiness, not just go, oh, that's just His Holiness, he's different. No. He's showing us his own example. That's why he's in a human body. He doesn't need a human body. If he's a Buddha, he's finished the job. He doesn't need a body. So the only reason he's in one is to show us. That's the point. When we hear that, it's very humbling. We'll go, my goodness, if he can do it, then we can too, you know? So the difference between someone like that, who shows that they're perky and happy no matter what, when his country's been destroyed, I mean, thinking, even hearing about one time, His Holiness, the sadness about the environment even, when all the animals are destroyed, every mineral's been ripped out, the whole country's a complete physical disaster, total environmental mess. It was like a Pure Land before, because Tibetans didn't kill things, you know, and they left everybody in peace, the worms could have a life, and the wild animals weren't even hardly wild. show, but now it's completely destroyed. I mean, I could hear him one time. He was so sad. But the thing is, when you've gone beyond ego, which we assume he has, gone beyond attachment, gone beyond fears, gone beyond jealousy, and this is really real words, you know, this is really Buddha's view. We can all do this. Then, of course, you've just only got space for limitless enthusiasm and limitless compassion. I mean, it's very logical if we understand the path, you know, and that's why we have to know where we're at on that path. So somehow, so if we can understand where we're at, then it gives us some courage to know, okay, we've got a long way to go, but it's all right. We've got the tools. We've got the methods. And I think that's a really powerful point. So often, you know, if you're on a journey, and even if it's only 5 miles, but you have no map, you could spend 12 hours trying to get to those 5 miles because you don't know where to go. This is a real example. But if you've got a 1,000-mile journey, but you have a map, you can relax. Because you know you've got a map and you follow the instructions and you enjoy each step of the way. This is a really powerful point, you know. So, of course, as we all know, the Tibetans, you know, the Buddhist path, and in particular the way the Tibetans present it, they say it's all structured, it's all organized, it's all incremental, step by step by step. The Lam Rim means that. But we don't seem to have much confidence. We kind of get confused and we get overwhelmed. Oh, my goodness, I don't know how to practice. I don't know what emptiness is. We always get overwhelmed. It's because we maybe just have not got enough confidence that the steps are there, you know. So it's up to us to take those steps. It's really like learning anything, but we forget. If you want to learn music and all you are is overwhelmed by how much music you can't play, but then you can forget all the teachers are there, all the music is there, all the path is there. You just have to know, get good teachers and follow the instruction, and then learn to enjoy each step of the way. It's a really important point. Then we become much more relaxed, much more kind of content. But we get overwhelmed, you know, because all the negativity and our depression and our anxiety loom large in our head. Then we kind of lose the plot. But it's all there. The structure's there. The steps are there, you know. You just follow them one step at a time. So we have both wings of the bird as a way of expressing the whole path, you know. The wisdom is all the nuts and bolts of the work you've got to do on yourself first. And then to that extent, you can then be a benefit to others. Otherwise, it's not possible. And that's one of the big mistakes, like I've been mentioning, in our culture. We try to leap into the compassion wing first because we think that's what it's all about. And it is all about that. But as compassion is on its own, it's not enough. This is all Inna says. As Lama Zopa says, meaning well is not enough. You've got to have the wisdom wing. And that means understanding karma and understanding your mind. That's the basis for understanding yourself. And then it becomes the basis for understanding everybody else. It's so practical, you know. So then we hear the word meditation, right, don't we? We hear meditation, some kind of magical word, and that really is the main word. Anybody thinks of Buddhism, the word they'd associated with is the word meditate. So that word, again, is massive for us. We really have a lot of confusion about what it is and how you do it and why. You know, what's its function? And even what is it? We have lots of misconceptions. So again, if we've been practicing Buddhism for years, we're still not quite sure what does it mean to meditate. Well, what's fascinating, first of all, is the Tibetan verb to meditate. It actually translates as to familiarize. That's very confusing to us. Huh? Familiarize? What are you talking about? Well, what it means is familiarizing your mind, because your mind meditates, to familiarize your mind with two things. That which is virtuous, and that which is true, wisdom and compassion, in other words. So familiarize, it's forcing us to think differently about what we think meditation means. There's this complete obsession in the whole world that somehow it's this magical thing that you do. You visualize a person sitting on a cushion with their eyes closed and their legs crossed, and you think, oh, that's the action of meditation. If you saw a person sitting in a chair, you wouldn't say, oh, they're meditating. You say, oh, they're sitting in a chair. We've got this kind of really cliche, very stubborn view that it's this thing you do when your legs are crossed. I mean, it's very peculiar. I'm not being sarcastic. But that happens to come from Asia, that's all. That's how Asians sit. I mean, not always. They all sit in chairs now. But we associate it with sitting cross-legged. It's very fascinating. So indeed, you know, that was the position, the physical body, the position of the physical body, of the body of the great meditators of the past. And there's a practical reason, if you're a serious meditator, and we're going to describe exactly what that means, if you're a serious meditator, then it's found to be the best position possible to be in what they call full lotus, I mean, you know, when you read the stories of great meditators, like, so for example, Geshe Lama Khonchog, this amazing yogi from, meditator from Sarajay, Geshe Lama's same monastery, Lama Zopa's monastery, Lama Yeshe's monastery. And he was there, like, you know, he was born in 27 or something. When he left Tibet in 59, he was young, and he left across the mountains, and then he went up into the hills in Nepal to one of the caves where Milarepa used to meditate, and he spent, you know, years and years in one cave, six, seven years, and then under a tree for a year and a half, and then another cave for many, many years before he finally came down to Kathmandu, and he came to live in Kopan Monastery. And soon after, Lama Yeshe passed away, you know? And that was in 84, and he died 20 years later. Yeah, about 20 years later. So I remember when he was there, when Lama Yeshe passed away, Lama Zopa said, all the smiles at Kopan went away. But when Geshe Lama Khonchog came, all the smiles came back. He was this amazing meditator, you know. I'm going to explain what that means, okay? So he was this great meditator. In the cliched sense, we'd understand he was yogi, and he lived in the mountains in a cave. He was an extreme meditator. You know, at some point he got to the point where he didn't need any clothing. He didn't need any food. He didn't need any house. He just had a little hole in the wall with a little bit of animal skin to sit on. And he would sit there for days and sometimes weeks in full lotus position, because when you got full lotus position and you're a serious meditator meditating, you know, days and night, that's good, you know, day and night, you fall over. You sit up there upright, because there's one thing wonderful about that position that keeps you very, very stable. So it's got real logic to it. But as you know, so as His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, if we can start our meditation session in that position, it's really auspicious and kind of sows the seeds or sets the imprint in our mind for our ability to do it in the future. But when we do the highest level meditations, the highest level of these meditations, like Geshe Lama Khonchog in his cave, you need to be in full lotus. It's the best position because it's stable. We say there for months without toppling, you know. Can you imagine that? Or weeks or days or hours. Imagine. You can imagine. We can't even do 5 minutes. So, and he lived in a cave. He didn't need sleep. He lived on the air. The Tibetans have this wonderful, the Tibetan medicine has this type of pill the doctors make and also the lamas can make. They take the essence from all the minerals and things of the world, and you put them together in these little pills, and these great, the meditators, you know, because they're focused on just meditating. They have to stop every 5 hours to get their dinner and all that rubbish. We have to do eat and sleep and go to the toilet. What a waste of time. You know, they live on these pills, and so they get very skinny, but these pills have got the essence of all the best things in the earth, so they stay very strong. But Geshe Lama Khonchog didn't even have to need that. He lived on what they call wind chulen. He ate the air. He was able to extract the essence of everything he needed to nourish his body from the air. Now that's pretty incredible. So, meditate. All right. So finally, at the highest stages, like someone like Geshe Lama Khonchog, he was a tantric yogi, which means he had all those practices down. And the key, that the essential thing at the highest stages, the final stages, what you're trying to do in meditation, trying to do in general in your life, is trying to remove from the mind, this is the job of being a Buddhist, from the beginning to the end, all the way to becoming a Buddha. You're trying to remove from your mind all the delusions. Now, of course, that idea sounds very abstract to us. And so the more we understand what the mind is, and the more we understand how we've been talking, that delusions are these misconceptions in it, totally polluting our mind from countless lifetimes, that we have to remove from the mind, which Buddha has found amazingly, remarkably, this is a unique quality of the Buddha's teachings. He has found that the delusions, neuroses, the ego-based unhappy states of mind, ego grasping, attachment, and all the other thousands that he has identified, that these are not at the core of our being. This is the actual heart of being a Buddhist. Like I've described, this is implied by the word Buddha itself, the etymology of the word Buddha, Sangye in Tibetan, Buddha in Sanskrit. The first syllable implies the eradication, complete eradication from our consciousness, all fear, all neuroses, all ego, and all the voices of ego, the delusions, the neuroses, the unhappy states of mind. Because Buddha has found from his own experience that these are not at the core of our being. Not only that, he says, he has also found that we can develop to perfection the other parts of our mind. Wisdom, love, clarity, etc., etc. These are natural to us. These are at the core of our being, and these cannot be removed. Now, initially, this is a very bizarre idea if we take the view of the brain, but Buddha's not discussing the brain, okay? That's not his expertise. That's fine, but he's not discussing that. Okay, these days, His Holiness has these marvelous conversations with the brain people, and he talks about his view of the mind, which is not the brain, and they're having wonderful meeting points. It's fantastic. But the Buddha's expertise is not the brain. It's not the body. It's the mind, which is not physical. So the bottom line of, and the thing behind every instruction in Buddhism, from entry-level junior school grade one in the first scope in junior school to the next level to the compassion wing to the final stages of the bodhisattva path all the way to tantra, the fundamental thing that underpins every second of practice, is the ability to remove from your mind the delusions and to grow the virtues, because that's what becomes a Buddha. And it's our mind that becomes a Buddha. So that's the job. That's the job to be done. So the greatest yogis, such as Geshe-lama Khonchog, who's done all the junior school, high school, university, postgraduate, perfected it all, and has gone to the mountains and disappeared into space and his little hole in the wall, disappeared to do this work 100%, 24 hours a day. That's the best. If you want to become a doctor, best you do it 24 hours a day. If you want to become anything, best to train 24 hours a day, you'll become the doctor in 1 year. But of course, most of us haven't got that much energy or enthusiasm because we have to eat, sleep, and go to the toilet, you know, and have rests all the time. Every 5 minutes we're going to have a break, don't we? Because we're not that enthusiastic. We're not that trained in anything. So these great yogis have got to the point with such renunciation, such wisdom, such compassion, and they've got the skill. They finally got the skill. So he sat there, you know, naked, in full lotus position, doing the work of familiarizing his mind with wisdom and compassion. That's it. So what's that mean? The very beginning, when we're completely, our mind is all over the place, isn't it? Completely berserk. It's just natural in our world. It's completely natural to have a mind that's just crazy, never stopping. We might be relatively reasonable, having nice breakfast, smiling at our friends, busy with the world, so we're not paying attention to the mind, and there's nothing dramatic arising, you know, but we know there's just this chat underneath all the time. Because why? Because we haven't ever controlled the mind, and we don't have in our culture any methods for controlling the mind. It doesn't exist. We have no skills called single-pointed concentration. These genius Indians invented it well before the Buddha, and this is a living, real, totally alive extant technique that people looking like you and me are doing this second and achieving the result, what they call single-pointed concentration. That's the first major step that we have to accomplish to do this job that Geshe-lama Khonchog was doing in the subtlety of his mind. And this is the point now. The mind, we live at the gross level right now. We are living at the sensory and the gross conceptual, which is a tip of the tip of the tip of the iceberg of our capacity for cognition, our mind itself. That's what that's how we're living. So at that level, our mind's uncontrolled. We can see that. Our senses are uncontrolled. We believe that cakes and handsome boys make us happy. We believe ex-boyfriends and, you know, the wrong cake makes us unhappy. So we spend our lives following attachment, which locates the objects we think we're delicious, and we ingest them through our five senses, thinking we'll get happy, but we only get more miserable, and then we throw away all the ugly things, and that's life, you know? Join the universe. It's called samsara. To one degree or another, we're like that. The ants, the dogs, the monkeys, and the humans. So luckily, we've got some access to some virtue. Aren't we fortunate? I mean, look at the world, you know? Unbelievable. It's incredible. You should be weeping in happiness every day to think that you've even got the thought that you want to be a better person, and you're actually looking out for courses and systems to help you become a better person. This is pretty incredible. You should be blissed out every day, you know? Unbelievable. So joyful. So given the long-term goal, the first major step in our progress in doing this job of ridding the mind of the rubbish and growing the goodness, the ideal first level of accomplishment has to be single point of concentration. Because why? Because we've got, this is the point, the Buddha, we've got these subtler levels of cognition. So at the gross level we live at now with the conceptuality, even if we're very virtuous, it is literally not possible, literally not possible with conceptuality to remove from the mind these primordial misconceptions. We need to access a subtler level. We need to go beyond, learn to get concentration, which is the first mode of meditation, single point of concentration, or generally known as calm abiding. It's the term that's given to the end result of this meditation technique that's described in the text in nine stages of cultivation. This is the first We can't really get far until we get there. Which doesn't mean we can't do something, but we're looking at major stepping stones. We can, you know, so the first one is to get this concentration. In other words, to access this subtler level of cognition. I like to call it the microscope of our mind. It's a really good analogy. Okay? So then, that concentration, you know, we've got to recognize here that we've got these subtle levels of mind. That we don't discuss this in our culture. There is no such level of cognition discussed in neuroscience because it's only discussing the gross level. And the gross level, if we take the Vajrayana model, the gross level is the gross sensory level, which is the function of this body, which dominates us completely. Our body looms large in our lives, and we even define most of our experiences of happiness and suffering in terms of the physical experiences, you know? So then we've got our mental consciousness, which is functioning at the very gross level of conceptuality, these very gross thoughts. They're the tip of the iceberg, and that's all we posit as existing in our culture. So then we talk about unconscious and subconscious, but there's no real clear understanding of it because we have no real clear techniques for accessing it. We've got sort of hit and miss things, and people might get hypnotized and have dreams, but it's not really, it's a bit hit and miss. So this Buddhist approach coming from these genius Indians before the Buddha, they're the ones who created this technique, which means they discovered this subtle level of mind. They're the ones who came up with it. You know, they observed it, their own mind, not with the microscope out there on a brain. And so they created this technique called single point of concentration. And these great Hindu yogis goes as far as they could go by going beyond the sensory, beyond the gross sense, the gross conceptuality. And they went to a certain level of what they called liberation. Well, Buddha went as far as he could go there, but he said still there was further to go. You hadn't removed from the mind all obscurations yet. You hadn't removed from the mind all delusions. So he diverged in his own direction. So that he took this technique with him. This is still existing in Buddhism, absolutely. Fundamental necessity. And that's the first level before we get too far, we've got to have that concentration. Because, very simple, these delusions in the mind, which are conceptual stories, this is eons old. It's very hard for us to hear this because we don't have a view of the mind like this. But this conceptuality is the cause of all our suffering. We've created stories. Delusions create stories, and then we habituate our mind with those stories, and then they impact upon our subtle physical energies, and then we get a rebirth. We create our future rebirths, you know. We book ourselves into the lion womb, or the human womb, or the alligator womb, or egg, according to the practices we do now. We program ourselves, and then when we die, we go to the appropriate house. An alligator mummy, an ant mummy, a lion mummy, or luckily a human mummy, if you're lucky, you know. Not lucky, practice virtue, because it all fits with the mind. So then we live at this gross level, just going from life to life to life, never noticing the mind at great depth, and just following our feelings. This is, of course, samsara, you know, no analysis of it. So we have to get this concentration. Why? Because we get to the subtle level, and it's only when you've got single point of concentration, as Ramayeshi says in his Mahamudra book, it is impossible, utterly impossible to actually deconstruct the subtlest delusion in the mind, the most primordial misconception known literally as ignorance, but known colloquially as ego grasping, this primordial misconception that clings to and believes in a solid, concrete, absolute, unchanging, intrinsic me. Of course, this is so subtle for us. We all can see as soon as we start talking about emptiness, we can't go blank, you know, because we're not familiar with the mistake. We can begin to identify the mind the way it mistakes with attachment and aversion, the grosser level. This is hard enough, but we can begin to become familiar with the way the mind conceptualizes and the mind distorts and embellishes. That's the key function of these misconceptions. But to really get somewhere, we've got to get concentration. Then we've got this brilliant, brilliant laser-like access, brilliant laser-like microscope of our mind, and that's accomplished in the first mode of meditation. But technically, that's not even really the meaning of meditation in Buddhism. It's just the technique. It's like sharpening your knife. The real work is to know how to use the knife. But we're so obsessed with concentration meditation, broadly known as mindfulness, very cliche in the modern world. And we have these different views about what we think it is, you know. So the grossest level, the usual cliched view, and it's better than nothing, of meditation is it's some kind of technique that you do to calm the mind down. We think it's like that. And it might. But it's not the point. This is so grossly not the point. It's a joke, you know. Of course, it's helpful to be calm, but that's not the main goal. But that's one of the main things we think. We think meditation, first of all, We think it's like learning to calm down. We think it's to, another thing we think of is to make the thoughts go away. Another thing we think is it's in a relaxation technique. It's none of those. The goal of getting, the goal of single pointed concentration is to access this subtle level of mind that's effortlessly, radiantly clear. And by the way, as a bonus, also blissful. You know, I'll read from Lama Yeshe's book. It's very inspiring. I mean, this is where, as a side piece, as a bonus, it's powerful to think about and hear and read the stories of the yogis and the views about the nature of mind. This gives us great courage even just to think about how our mind, our capacity for cognition, our consciousness has this unbelievable potential. Unbelievable potential for clarity. And listen to this, but clarity and joy. I mean, before I come back to meditation, I want to talk about this. And I'll wander off, but I'll come back again. This is something I think if we could have confidence in this, just from reading the yogi stories, reading the teachings, it would really give us inspiration. Where there's no view like this in our culture because we only posit the brain. And I'm not criticizing, it's just a fact. So what the Buddha is saying is consciousness, our capacity for cognition, isn't in its nature physical. And when we've begun, you know, to harness the crazy physical energy and the crazy level of the grossest illusions to enable us to get to this subtle level, which is like a miracle. I mean, you know, just to get to the point where you want to get to the mountains, to get single point of concentration, you've got to be solely, so highly realized. I mean, I always quote Venerable Rene, our Swiss monk friend, who's been a serious meditator all his Buddhist life. Almost from the time he first met Lama Yeshe, he decided that was his path, you know. So I interviewed him in 1995. In Urselding, a marvelous center in the Sierra Nevada in Spain, just near Granada, where incidentally Lama Ursel's parents were, and he was born around there, Lama Yeshe's reincarnation. So I interviewed him in 1995 in Mandalay. And, he was talking about this, I think year and a half or two and a half, I can't remember, year single pointed concentration retreat. Which means he's going to be, he wasn't like Geshe-la Mkhondro, not yet. He did have clothing and he did eat food because, you know, he's not highly realized enough. Geshe-la Mkhondro didn't need food, didn't need clothing. He was in 6 foot of snow in the winter in a hole in the wall with no wall because he's such a great yogi. He's able to generate heat in his own body and doesn't need the external world. I mean, that's advanced, but nevertheless, Rene, pretty amazing that he was, you know, was able to stay in one place, in one small house, have his meals provided and live in that place day after day after day, unfailingly 12, 14, 16 hours a day in series of sessions, focusing, doing this unbelievable training for his mind to become focused. Now, why do you think our mind can't be focused? Because we are complete and total junkies for comfort. Forget whether we're attached to video games, pornography, you know, fishing, killing people, that's the worst one to be attached to, or just eating cake, or just, but the real bottom line of attachment that prevents us from even beginning to even think of getting single point of concentration, even beginning to get the conditions together that we're unable to begin to work on it. I mean, he said there was no way in the world he could have gone to the mountains, literally, or metaphorically, in order to get concentration, because you need very specific conditions. There was no way in the world he could have done that unless he'd been a monk living in vows, which is already a powerful point, which means he wasn't had to be involved in sex and drugs and rock and roll and babies and insurance and mortgages. And that's not being critical. If you want to become like Roger Federer, you need to concentrate 12, 14 hours a day. It's the same thing here. It's not being punitive, you know? If you really want to focus on doing something, you'll do it completely, 100%. So it's obvious to be a monk, or, you know, and then the power of vows is so stupendous for our mind. We really do not get that psychologically. But if we can understand that, we'd really be crying with sadness not to be living in vows, because it's the most stupendous practice for our mind. Living in vows, he said, without living in vows for years, doing lots of purification practice and doing lots of Buddhist study of the philosophy and the psychology and the metaphysics, studying it. Knowing what the mind is, understanding the delusions well, understanding the emptiness, all of these things. And not only that, but even having to have to teach the Dharma. He said, without all of that background, there is no way he would have been qualified to sit in that little room, quite pleasant room, having his meals provided, but to have the rigor and the discipline to day after day and to struggle against what? Attachment. That's it, attachment. We have no idea what attachment is. You know, we only express it as a very gross level. But even if we're not a junkie for, you know, whether it's porn or whatever it might be, we think we're just nice people. But we're completely driven by attachment. And it's something critical. It should be a revelation to us. This is why we can't control our thoughts more than 1 second. It's why we get upset really easily. It's why the tiniest thing goes wrong, we get stressed out. It's why we need about 8 hours, 10 hours of sleep. We only need 6 meals a day because we're constantly complete junkies. Even if we're the nicest people, you've got to understand this. Not being critical, it's a revelation, though, to understand the depths of attachment. It's driving everything we do. Just don't hear it as critical. Just hear it as a revelation. Wow, I didn't realize it, you know. So to get to the point where you can give, you know, as I say in the text, as Pabongka Rinpoche says, just to be ready to go to a mountain to start getting concentration, you need to have completely given up any interest in any kind of food. You have whatever you're given. You do not care what you're given. You'll happily eat it. You know, dramas, you know? You have no interest in all the in normal things. And of course it goes without saying. You can't possibly have partners and babies and mortgages. I mean, that would be completely absurd. How could you sit there for 14 hours a day for 5 years and not think of them? I mean, it's like you'd be thrown in prison for being irresponsible. So it's obvious you have to throw away, this, you know, all the things that would be interfering with you. Just like you would want to become like Roger Federer. No one criticizes you. They admire you for your effort. Same here. It's obvious. And the obstacle is attachment. The obstacle is attachment. That's the bottom line every day. The grosser levels of that, the grosser delusions that come out of attachment are anger and violence. They're the ones that cause all the problems. But attachment is the main one. And the attachment we have mostly is comfort zone. It's to feel good every second. And whatever it is that triggers that, we'll do it. You know, we think. It doesn't actually bring us any happiness at all. It just makes us more stressed and more anxious. We don't realize that. So it's a stupendously profound practice just to want to have your mind a little bit stable. And why do you want to have single point of concentration? Well, think about it. I mean, there's quite a lot of bonus. I'll read you from Lama Yeshe. It's mind-boggling. The bonus is incredible when you begin to taste the bliss of your own mind. And this is the kind of interesting point. I remember, you know, we think, why are we trying to eat? Why do we eat cake? Why do we have houses? Why do we have jobs? You know, why do we have husbands and wives and children and things? And, you know, and then why do we video games or pornography or whatever it is that we're attached to? Whatever it is, join the universe, people. That's our method for getting happy. That's it. That's our method. We don't have another method in our culture. What does happy mean? There's so many things to say. I'm going to go and branch them off because every time I say something, I've got to branch off to something else, but I'll get back. I'm still getting to the point. We'll end up the day with probably the point. It's okay. We're getting there. So listen to this. This is very powerful to understand this. This is technically extremely important, you know? It's extremely important to understand this point. When we look at the mind, as we've been discussing, there are three levels of consciousness, three classifications of our mental states. One is the negative ones, the neurotic ones, the I-based ones, the delusions. They're the drama. They're the problem. To subdue them. One is the virtues, and we're trying to grow them. But the third one is like the mechanics. I like to call it the mechanics of the mind. And there's many there. They're the ones that enable us to concentrate. They're called concentration, good memory, discrimination, alertness, intention, attention. There's many of these, and these are developed and trained in concentration meditation. These are these brilliant parts of our mind. So in their character, mechanics is a good word. They're not physical, but we absolutely need these. And whether you're a murderer or a meditator, you need them. They're not good or bad in their nature, but they're necessary. Absolutely vital. Now, in that category, there's one called feeling. This is peculiar to us because we think that is like an emotion. But no, it's not equivalent to an emotion at all. Feeling is, there's only three kinds of feeling we have. One is called pleasant, which is another word for happiness. One is called unpleasant, which is another word for suffering. And the third one is called neutral. Well, forget the neutral, okay? Let's not worry about them. So we know all we want is pleasant feelings. And that's the thing about happiness. We are so addicted. Because we've got attachment, which is this junkie in us that is searching out there for the object that it is convinced, attachment is convinced, such that when I get it, a good feeling is triggered. And that's exactly what happens now. That's our method for getting happy feelings. The only way we can get a happy feeling is by getting an object that triggers it. Because feeling is the ability to have a pleasant, is a pleasant feeling. Pleasant feeling. And then there's unpleasant feelings. And we spend our lives trying to avoid the unpleasant feelings and trying to get the pleasant feelings. We spend our lives trying to avoid the unpleasant feelings and to get the pleasant feelings. And the job, the one part of our mind that does that job is called attachment. Is this vampire in us that's super focused, unceasing, every second, helped by attention, intention, concentration. All those parts of our mind are supporting attachment, and we locate the object that we've got a habit to be from, you know, the object that we're convinced is the one that starts it. When I get that object, it will trigger pleasant feelings. That's how we spend our lives. So the really heavy duty, unhappy people are the ones who, you know, jump on little girls and murder and rape and torture, because that's their habit, and that's how they get their pleasant feelings. Well, we might just have to go and watch videos or watch some porn or eat a cake, you know, or do whatever we do, or knit, or play tennis. Some of them we can see are fairly mild, but they don't harm others. At least stop doing the harming others ones. That's a good, you know, starting point. But the junkie in us is attachment, and it's craving. It's a craving. In its nature, it's desperate and hungry and craving and frantic. And it's desperate to find one of those objects that we're familiar with based on our karma, such that when we have contact with it, a pleasant feeling is triggered. So listen to this. That's the only way we know how to get a pleasant feeling. Think of just sitting in your chair now, you know. You'll get a pleasant, you know, if you, you know, you'll get a pleasant feeling for 5-10 minutes maybe. And then your leg will hurt, so you have to move your leg. And then you'll get up and get some lunch. And you sit down and you do something else. Every 5 minutes we're constantly changing whatever it is that gives a pleasant feeling. But because it turns into an unpleasant feeling, we have to do something else. That's how we spend our lives. That's how we spend, because we have no way of understanding how to trigger pleasant feelings. Now, Buddha's saying, listen, people, I found a method to get such pleasant feelings, you won't believe it. And I'm being quite literal here. Buddha's saying the end result is such pleasant feelings. It's the nature of your mind. This is what I'm trying to get to. When we can begin to read the literature about the nature of our mind, when it's to the degree that it's unencumbered by delusions, is the degree that it is blissful. And that's a real word. Our mind in its nature, when it's unencumbered by the junk, unencumbered by the gross conceptuality, unencumbered by the sensory consciousness, unencumbered by the delusions, it is just naturally radiant, naturally joyful, naturally clear. Please hear these words. It's scientific language, not religious. It's not a belief. It's the way our mind is. So, when you get single point of concentration, that's when you really taste that. But that's the bonus. That's not the point. It's just a bonus. It's incidental. It's incidental, but it's powerful to hear that our mind has this capacity, you know. I mean, this is not in our culture because a brain doesn't have that capacity. Very simple. A brain does not. And this is why we call this religion, because it sounds like belief to us, you know. And what's preventing us from accessing our own capacity for joy is attachment. That's it. Habit. To follow this and follow that, and you know, and of course we are all junkies. I'm not sarcastic when I say that. It should humble us, and it should give us compassion for ourselves. The depth of this drive in us that's frantic to get good feeling through the usual method of getting an object of the senses. That's it. Or using your creative imagination and living in fantasy worlds, which is the way some people do it. They sit there and just, you know, fantasize all day. So vividly that, you know, it even triggers pleasure or pain. Our minds are very creative, you know. This is attachment energy. And it's desperate for comfort. That's its main problem, is attached to comfort. We want our comfort zone. We've created our comfort zone. We want to stay within that comfort zone. And the millisecond it's threatened, you know, we freak out, you know. So it's very scary. So to imagine, even just like Renee, to get to be at the point where you can you imagine right now walking away this second out the front door, not turning back, with nothing in your hands. And you go up the mountains and you find a little hole in the wall and you sit down. Can you imagine? Like a joke. You'd be mad before you even leave. You'd be insane. Before you even leave the house, you'd be insane. So these are the obstacles that are preventing us from getting single point of concentration. Like someone said last night, you're Zach. Of course you can't do this if you haven't got renunciation. Renunciation is giving up attachment, giving up all the maniac, giving up all the crazy parts of our mind, you know? So you can sit there, and then don't think meditating is joyful. I mean, the effort in the beginning to get single point of concentration is absolutely stupendous. It's unbelievable effort. You have to have incredible discipline. I mean, we're not talking about getting that yet. We're just trying to get the discipline to control our lives, to have a decent practice in the morning, to do our job, you know, to not just to be junkies all day, following what we want, you know, and misusing our employer's money, misusing our, I mean, we've just got to, even just that level, that level of effort and discipline is unbelievable for us. But the thing is, but why it's so hard to see why we should do it. As all the lamas say, you only have enthusiasm for something if you know the benefit. But we don't know the benefits of not having attachment. We only know the benefits, seemingly, although they're not benefits. We can't see it. We only know the benefits of the quick fix, you know, and we are junkies. This is, even when nicest people and never hurt a fly, still attachment is completely driving every one of us. Just to know it is very powerful. So we have to make effort, you know, and have discipline. It's very clear. So the first level we want to get you to really get somewhere is get single point of concentration. And 99% of us in this room here won't get it, won't even go to the mountains to get it. That's fine. We start somewhere. But with what? Discipline. Controlling our body, controlling our speech, living in vows, controlling our mind. That prepares us. That prepares us, you know? So what's the point of all this? Reminding the point of all this. We've got to get single point of concentration. Why? Okay, the bonus is nice to hear. Lama goes on about the bonus. He's very, you know, gets excited. How amazing the results will be just for oneself. I remember Venerable Rene saying, he was in meditation retreat for a couple of years. I can't remember now. This first retreat, he's been retreating nonstop since then. He teaches in between, you know. He said, there's no question, Rabina. He maybe touched upon the fifth of the nine stages. He said, there's no question that the joy, I forget the words he used, the joy I experienced in my mind, in concentration meditation, his mind, the joy, the bliss, I forget the words, that I experienced was so superior to any joy I had ever experienced through my senses. So please hear these words. They're very practical. Because the interesting point about mind, the joy we know now, whether it's, you know, again, whether it's watching porn or just having cake, low-level kinds of joy, kind of desperate joy, you know, whatever, or really delicious joy, you have the best boyfriend on the planet, you know, whatever joy it is. So we can see it only lasts for a second. We don't question that. That's why we keep having the object. I mean, if you just say, you know, I've had the best sex in the universe, now I've done, I'm finished, now I've got it. No, we've got to do it again and again and again. We know that. It's exhausting. Not to mention cakes and food. So that's our trouble. But the thing is, okay, that's the only way we know how to do. So, and the other point is, when we look at the pleasure we get, which is usually pretty gross. I mean, as you said, the pleasure we get even from our best sex is really kind of, really gross. It's really kind of greedy and makes the mind very dull. There's no clarity. You lose all, it's like an animal, you know? We have really gross, really gross sensory pleasure, gross sensory activity that triggers pleasure. The pleasure, which is the best we can imagine, is unbelievably gross. I'm not trying to be rude here, you know? In comparison with the ability of our mind to experience joy at a subtler level, then it's not dependent upon the senses. I mean, this is why we just think of it as religion, so we think it's kind of boring, you know? But it's not religion, it's just psychology. It's Buddha's view of the mind, you know, and its capacity. So he said, so when you have the usual joy we have, you know, it's very distressing, very disturbing, very loud, very, very kind of bumpy. But everybody even has a slight meditation experience and it's valid experience. They will say it's very calm, very peaceful. So to have bliss and peace together sounds very weird to us, you know. Bliss sounds to us like hyperventilating. But this is our mind. This is what Lama Yeshe all the time will try to get to us, to show us the power of our own mind, the potential of our own mind, experientially, the bliss, the joy we're capable of. Very, very powerful to think of this. So in this long-term job we're trying to do of uprooting these misconceptions in the mind, especially finally uprooting the root delusion, the ego grasping, and that's the next major turning point we have to make. Let's quote-unquote realize emptiness. And then there's still plenty more work to do, but these major stepping stones. Concentration is the first one, and then realizing emptiness is the next one. And you cannot possibly, as Lama Yeshe says, cut the subtlest, cut the deepest delusion from the mind, using logic to argue with that misconception on the basis of laser-like focus. It is impossible without that laser-like focus. Why? Because the delusion is so primordial in our mind, you know. So hard to identify. You can't do it without the microscope of your mind. You can't see it without the microscope of your mind. And that's single point of concentration. So the job, meditation then, the real meditation is the second one. This first one is really just sharpening the knife. Now you use the knife to do the proper job. That's where you do the work of ridding the mind of the rubbish and growing the goodness. That's the proactive, actual job. That's the meaning of the Tibetan word, gom. You're familiarizing your mind with wisdom, and you're familiarizing your mind with virtue. So what does familiarize mean? It just means learning. You don't sit, oh, what are you doing, Robbie? Robbie's a pianist, right? What are you doing today, Robbie? Oh, I'm familiarizing my mind with Bach. He doesn't say that. He says, I'm practicing Bach. We get what he means. He's familiarizing his mind and indeed his fingers with Bach. We know that. We don't call it familiarizing. It just means he's practicing it. And we all know practice makes perfect. So we have to familiarize our mind. That's the bottom line. On the basis of getting single point of concentration. That's not the purpose at all. Actually, single point of concentration is not even a virtuous activity. It's just a technique. It's your motivation that makes it virtuous. So on the basis of getting concentration, on a basis of sharpening the knife, you now use the knife to do the actual job. And that's the real meaning of meditation is the second one, which they call, insight. It's the end result. It's a great word in English. Don't make it fancy. Don't make it religious, Insight means you get something. You understand. Oh, I get it. Your penny has dropped. You get something. That's what insight means. So here they're talking about a subtle insight into the nature of reality, into ego grasping. You're removing it, understanding it. Like I said yesterday to whoever it was, someone, Margaret, wasn't it? Margaret, I said it to you. Yeah, it was. When it's the seeing, recognizing, the finally seeing nakedly and crystal clearly that the fantasy eye you thought was there has never been, isn't, and never could be. That's when you've got to have laser-like focus for, which is the first mode. But the real job is the second one. The real work is in the second one. Now, this is where we have so many misconceptions as well. We know very well in Tibetan they refer often to the second mode of meditation as analytical meditation. Well, that's referring to the technique that gets you insight. It's the technique that gets you the insight. So that also we fantasize. It sounds so confusing to us. Analytical meditation. If we think meditation is not thinking, we're so confused when we hear analytical meditation. Well, it's just a fancy term. I'm sorry to disappoint you. It's a fancy term for the verb to think about something. Analysis is a fancy word for thinking. But proper thinking. Like intelligent thinking. When Robbie's studying Bach's theories, before he has to put his hands on the piano, he's got to use common sense and think through carefully the meaning of all those things. He doesn't just got to go on, we just don't go, oh yeah, think about something, go around in circles like how we do now. That's why we've got to have concentration. So you're going to have proper thinking, intelligent thinking, focused thinking, thinking that doesn't go in one ear and out the other, which is what most of our mind is doing all day. You've got to train your mind to be brilliantly, brilliantly, brilliantly focused and analytical. Think through something. So why do we have to use an analysis? And what the hell are we trying to analyze? Well, this is the point we have to understand about the mind, Buddha's view, so unique to the Buddha. When you study the epistemological model of the mind, when you study Lorig, I'm sure some of you people have studied it there, you'll learn the way the mind functions, which is absolutely brilliantly fascinating. Modern science would be so blissed out to study Buddha's, the epistemological model, the way mind functions, but they've got to first establish the possibility that they're not discussing the brain. That's their problem. They're discussing the actual cognitive process itself. The way mind functions. So at that level, we have sensory and we have mental. So sensory, like already I've described, we give it so much more power than it really has. We're junkies for the feelings in our bodies. We think, because everything's the body. We're so gross. We make the body the boss, as she says. It's like a joke. The sensory consciousnesses are completely limited in their capacity for cognition. We're given so much more power than they really have. And that misleads us terribly. And because we're addicted to good feelings and not wanting bad feelings, we assume they're physical. That's why we think of emotions as physical. That's why we don't even notice what we're thinking until it's vomiting out the mouth. We're so gross in our comprehension. But we've got mental consciousness, and that's where the workshop is, as Lama Yeshe says. Lama Zopa. That's where the workshop is. That's what we have to become familiar with. We have to unpack and unravel the seeming utter chaos in there. And it is chaos right now. Complete chaos. Because we never controlled it. We don't have techniques like that. We've got genius techniques. Now, we do have with the mind. It's fascinating. When Robbie can sit and play Bach, he has organized his thoughts to the most sophisticated degree, hasn't he? That's how come he can do anything. I mean, it's like the thinking that goes before you go anywhere near putting your fingers on the piano. It's unbelievable. I mean, musical theory, classical music theory is so bloody complex. It's like mathematics. It's and the language those funny notes on the piano, on the piece of paper they use. It's such an abstract language. It's so sophisticated. It's unbelievable. That's called intellect. That's called concepts. Don't think it's not. You've got to completely train your mind at a mental level to harness all your thinking to this most sophisticated method of musical theory before you can put one finger on the damn piano. It's so obvious. So we know how to organize the mind. We're geniuses of the intellect. We're geniuses at math and music and cooking and all the external intellectual things. But we don't have that same skill when it comes to emotional thoughts. This is Buddha's, that's Buddha's expertise. The clarity and precision and depth of analysis and rigor and discipline that we know we need to employ to be a musician, to be a cook, to be a scientist is exactly what Buddha's saying in order to become this amazing person we can become. His expertise is what's called emotions, not how we think, so gross. So we have to go beyond the physical, beyond the intellectual, and begin beyond the grosser level to begin to observe every second of the day, this utter, unedited chaos, which is our thoughts. And we think that's normal. Of course it's normal, but we're all insane, basically. We're living in insanity all day. It's a miracle we don't go around killing each other, everybody else, all the time. And we haven't got a clue what's going on until it vomits out in the mouth. Or until you can't get out of bed one morning because you're inert with depression. So that's Buddha's expertise, to unpack and unravel the amazing contents of our mental consciousness. And to distinguish the neuroses from the virtues. That's our job. And then you're going to see at the level we function, at the gross level of mental consciousness, is we live at a level of conceptuality, including all your emotions. Anger is rooted in being a conceptual story. Depression is rooted in being a conceptual story. But we only notice the body. We're so gross. We only notice the physical experience. That's the tip of the iceberg. The body is not anger. It's just the expression, the physical manifestation of what the mind in the body is doing. We have to get to that. That's Buddha's expertise. That's why we have to concentration. And then we begin the brilliant job of being a Buddhist, which is to distinguish between the facts and the fiction. And that's the point about all the dramas, all the emotions. Love is an emotion, yes. Compassion is an emotion, yes. But it's conceptually rooted. It's a concept. What is love? Love is a thought. May you be happy. And when you have it hugely for your beloved, then you're in tears as well and your body's shaking. That's amazing, nothing wrong. But it's rooted in a thought. Anger is a thought. How dare you do that to me? I don't deserve it. And then you harm them and kill them. It's all thoughts. It's all thoughts. And because these thoughts are so spontaneous, we've come fully programmed with these thoughts. And then you have to practice them. You have to be taught. And the root one, the man underneath anger, attachment, the junkie in us, desperate, frantic, this emotional hunger, this vampire. Frantic for good feelings. Frantic for good feelings. And it believes the only way to get them is to touch an object, see an object, taste an object, think about an object. You can see that, you know. Like video games, it's not sex. You don't have to do anything except, you know, just think. It's just all thinking. Isn't it? Well, so is porn on a computer, just thinking as well. You haven't got a girl next to you. You've just got the pictures. So it's all our creative imagination. And what's that? That's concepts. It's all concepts, and it's attachment concepts, junkie. So 4 or 5 hours a day, what have you been eating? A cake. Even though the body included eating the cake, the main one is intellectual. The main one is conceptual. Your thoughts about the cake, your visualization of the cake, your imagining of the cake, your interpretation of the taste. It's still mainly your mind that's working overtime, and it's all concepts. That's what we have to understand. So then we have to unpack those concepts, because Buddha says one lot are liars. They're leading us up garden paths. They're maniac, delusional liars. We believe these lies for eons. And the root lie that informs all of them is the one about the, you know, the dualistic intrinsic me. So we've got masses of inner work to do, to unpack and unravel. And the method you use for this is intelligent thinking, like you do, like Robbie does for his music, like you do for your science, like you do if you're addicted to those porn things or you're addicted to video games. I've heard about video games. You use all this intelligent thoughts, very clever thinking. You're addicted to that. You're using your concepts the whole time, consciously. That's what attachment is. Very clever concepts, you know, thoughts about things. That's what we all live at. And that's what causes suffering. You know? So you have to identify these as lies and realize that, that contact with that object is not bringing us any happiness at all. But we are very stubborn. We can't bear to see that. It's too painful for us. It's too unbearable to think that what we do all the time isn't bringing us happiness. We are convinced it does, but our experience tells us it doesn't. We can't bear to face it because we're junkies. You know? We can't, it's too painful for us. So we keep doing it again, hoping the next cake will do it, the next job will do it, the next girl will do it, you know. Maybe I'll get pleasure next time. So I mean, we should be having compassion for ourselves. So we've got to get to concentration, to begin to harness this incredible maniac mind of ours, and to get to laser-like focus, which incidentally gives you bliss and joyful, and then now you use it. So this is now to get to the two modes of meditation, get to the crunch now. You've got to have your concentration. And that's simply a tool. And what do you do with it? You do what you do in the second mode. So what do you do in the second mode of meditation? What do you want to get insight into? Well, the fact of the matter is, finally, you've got to get insight into emptiness. But all the other things we've been learning in Buddhism, starting with karma and all the different concepts that Buddha's telling us are are reality, we've got to familiarize our minds with those as well. So he's telling us that karma is the law that runs the universe. He's telling us that we're not created by a creator. He's telling us that our mummy and daddy didn't give us a mind. He's telling us that our mind isn't the brain. He's telling us that our mind is not physical. He's telling us our mind came from before. He's telling us that cause and effect is the law that runs the universe. He's got a very different model of the universe. That's his science. And we want to become a Buddhist, that you've got to learn his science. That's naturally what it is. Robbie doesn't sit there with Bach's music saying, what's this stupid man talking about? He's decided to buy into Bach's theories, you know. So we've decided to buy into Buddhist theories. Don't just fill your head with them, because what is in your head then impacts upon your experience. Robbie just doesn't fill his head with theory and then put his hands on the piano and they stop. He's in trouble. Well, he doesn't cook. He doesn't, you know, he says he's a great cook and he says he is. I've never known. He cooks me a meal every time I come. He does that. Definitely does. He's a good cook, I promise. He's said to be a French cook. What's those fancy words in French? Never mind. So if he just had the theories in his head, but he wouldn't even know how to break an egg into the pot, he'd be a phony, wouldn't he? So the same with science or anything else. You've got to start with the thoughts, but then you've got to put your money where your mouth is. So you've got to familiarize your mind with karma. How do you do that? So when we think of meditation, we've got these cliched ideas. We've got to have concentration. Then I go to the second mode, analytical. I've got to think about, I'll go, karma, law of cause and effect, karma, karma, law of cause and effect, karma, waiting for some penny to drop. How stupid. Well, he doesn't go, you know, B flat, E major, F this. No, he thinks it, makes it coherent, and then his fingers do the work. You think the theory, you think the recipe, and then your hands do the work. Same here. You've got to have clarity. You've got to have some kind of concentration before you can put one coherent sentence together. It's clear you need concentration first. Then you use it in the second mode, and not just classically in the single point of concentration, you know, method. You might not have concentration. So to the degree that you have any concentration at all in your daily life, you then do that level of thinking. So you hear about karma, you go home, and you sit down, and you think it through. It's like doing your homework. We do this every day. We learn. When I first heard that 1 + 1 = 2, it was a brand new idea to me. Oh, Mummy, Miss Holton told me that 1 + 1 = 2. She wants me to do she wants me to get insight into it. That's what she would have said if she was a Buddhist. She would have said, go home, Rabina, get some single point of concentration. Now go to the second mode, and I want you to get insight into this, and I want you to do some analytical meditation. That's exactly what she would have said. And what she's really saying is, go home, Rabina, take this information I've just given you. Make sure it's correct. Because if you write down that 1 + 1 = 3, you'll never get the answer until the cows come home. You've got to have the right information, which is intellect. You go home, you close the door, you tell your sisters and brothers to leave you in peace, you close the door, you get some focus, and now you go to the second mode, and you then get your information with your concentrated mind, and you think it through. You don't just go, 1 + 1 = 2, 1 + 1 = 2, 1 + 1 = 2. No, that's stupidity. You think it through, you use your noggin. That means you've got to know what 1 means. You've got to know what plus means. You've got to know what 2 means. You've got to know what equals. You've got to have the concepts in your mind. And then one moment you go, oh, I get it. And the penny drops. Mummy, I get it. That's an insight. And that's how you get enlightened. So you keep you listen to the teachings first. You listen to the theories. Then you go home and you think about them while you're listening. Then you contemplate them. And then you get some concentration. And then you internalize them in your meditation. From here to enlightenment, that's the job. And that's the meaning of meditation. You're familiarizing your mind with wisdom and virtue until you've perfected it, until your mind is oneness with wisdom and virtue. That's it. That's a Buddha. Listen to these foreign words they use, and we get confused, you know. So the job is the mind. You've got to control the body, control the speech first, because it's berserk. begin to work on our mind, get some kind of discipline, have our practice, keep our vows. They're the really powerful support. You can't get a, you can't get ahead of the game without living in vows, Lama Zopa says. Being good is not enough. Being a nice person is not enough. You've got to live in your vows, which is stupendous psychologically. And you do your practice every day and your purification every day and your study every day. And that's how you keep moving. You keep growing and you develop and you have some discipline. Okay, we can't do like Geshe-la Kontrog. We're not qualified enough to go to the mountains naked and meditate 24 hours a day like he could. Because he had perfect concentration and he was able to do the job perfectly in the subtlest level of his mind without break. We're not like that. So we do our best. We do our best. But we've got to have discipline. Otherwise, it's like chaos. Discipline is the first one, and that is everybody's hardest one. We all know that. We all know that. And this is the kind of the suffering. This is the irony of our good lives, I think, because we are so fortunate. We're not living under the bridge. We're not junkies. We're not got abuse, maybe might have some, but you know, in general, we've got a blessed life. But that's the problem for us, because it's satisfying our attachment. And then we feel lucky, but this hubris, oh, aren't I lucky? So we don't use it. We just sink into it, like, you know, like animals with respect to us. We sink into the comfort zone, thinking we're so fortunate and calling that happiness. It is a level of happiness, but we're not using it properly. We're pissing it down the toilet, excuse me, because we're attached to it. So it's only when we lose our comfort, it's only when we lose our job or lose our girlfriend, that's the wake-up call. And our trouble is we are so gross, we don't notice that things are going wrong until the wake-up call. And then we really start to work. Everyone says that. When you have big problems, that's the wake-up call. We don't wait for the wake-up call, okay? Start work now is the point. And the point is this too. Every time we give the power to the attachment and sink into the object, which is, and why, ostensibly, to get pleasure, and it does trigger some pleasure, that's definite. Every time we do that, we're increasing attachment, not increasing the pleasure. That's something that technically we have to understand. Technically, we have to, the more we technically understand the relationship between karmic imprint, attachment, and feeling, the more we understand the technical relationship between karmic imprint, attachment, and feeling, the more technically we understand that, the more it'll tell us, show us how we're locked in this system of samsara. So it's like this, you know, it's like this. I always use the example, say, a fisherman, because that's an action that harms others. At least if you're just watching porn, you're just harming yourself, you know. Eat cake, you're harming yourself. Watch your video games, you're harming yourself. But then, you know, incidentally, then you're not giving so much attention to everybody else, but you're directly harming others. That's why the Buddha says, at least at the beginning, stop killing, raping, stealing. At least the gross objects, you know, the gross actions. So relationships like this. So there's this boy. I was thinking of this boy, you know, the fisherman. And he's like fishing. When he's tiny, he's not thinking of fishing because mummy hasn't brought him fishing. But one day he sees the scenario called fishing. So that triggers, instantaneously, that triggers the karmic imprint, which is like memory. It's in the memory. It's so vivid. It's like memory. It's like as if he recognizes it. So that's what karmic imprints are. That's why a person tortures. That's why a child will torture. That's why a child will be having crying with compassion for the lice in his own head. It's a habit, whatever the habit is. So this particular boy, very nice boy, lots of good qualities, he meets fishing for the first time. So what happens is the second that scenario appears in front of him, it triggers his memory. It triggers the karmic imprint. And now this is the point here. The stronger the karmic imprint, which is meaning the stronger the habit, in his case, of killing, in this in particular life as fish, the stronger the habit, the more vivid the appearance of that being familiar will be to him. That instant, it triggers really joyful feelings. And then the same instant, practically, like in the first, all in the millisecond, then attachment kicks in. So feeling is not attachment. Feeling is not negative. It's not positive. Happy feelings are happy feelings. They're not good or bad. We conflate completely. We conflate attachment and pleasure. It's a complete technical mistake. Attachment is an over-distorted, demented, ridiculous, delusional state of mind that's a junkie that is constantly craving the object so that we'll get the good feeling. Attachment doesn't even want the cake, actually. It wants the good feeling on the contact with cake. So attachment is the junkie. That's the poison. Feeling is just simply the joy, the moment of pleasure or the moment of suffering. That's it. Pleasure is not the object. suffering is not the object, but we are so addicted to the physical experiences and we're so addicted to the external world. We think, when I ask you, well, did you have a nice day today? You'll tell me all the nice things that happened, but you're just describing the cake and the boyfriend. They're just the objects. They're not pleasure. The weather is not pleasure. There's something to do with it. Pleasure's in your mind. Feeling is a mental state. But we're so addicted to the external world being the cause of it that we conflate the physical world with pleasure and we conflate attachment with pleasure. We've just got the wrong, we haven't got the technical explanation correct. So the fisherman sees the scenario, it triggers his memory, and the stronger the habit, the more that instant unbelievable pleasure is generated. And the next millisecond, attachment takes over, and attachment's job is to write this amazing, to describe it as the most divine thing since sliced bread. So you think of somebody, I remember Robert Hughes, it was the arts writer for New York for the Time magazine for like 40 years. He's an Australian writer. He's dead now. I remember reading that he was really into fishing, and he talked about the first time he went trout fishing. He said it was like a cosmic experience. So technically, let's look at that. That means he had the incredibly strong habit from past killing. He first met fishing when he went trout fishing, and it triggered intensely. I mean, like cosmic experience. It's like sex. It's like intense, blissful feelings. So the extent of the blissful feeling we experience is equal to the extent of the karmic habit to do it. That's why we are junkies. So what happens with us is this pathetic old cake. You meet the cake. It triggers a memory of karmic habit of food. It triggers a feeling. And then attachment kicks in and writes a novel about how delicious it is. And that's how we stay paralyzed in samsara. That's the process that keeps us locked in samsara. Because the fact is this. Attachment is a junkie that is frantic for good feelings. So obviously, if when you see fishing, it triggers good feelings. Obviously, when you have sex, it triggers good feelings. Obviously, when you torture somebody and it triggers good feelings, because whatever the habit is, it triggers good feelings. Of course you want to do it again. Because you think that the torture is the cause of the good feelings. But that's the mistake. Technically, it is not true. But we make mistake in our assessment. Because it all happens so quickly. Feeling is simply feeling, happy or unhappy. And as Amayeshi would say, the more pleasure, the better, dear. And Buddha happens to have methods of how to trigger unbelievable bliss without stupid cakes and video games and, when I don't get too gross, I have to be careful, control my mind. Are we communicating, people? I'm sure we are. So we can see, forget about porn, forget about torture. Look how hard it is to resist a piece of cake. I mean, we're all suckers, you know, because attachment, the feeling is triggered. The moment you even think about the cake, you get excited. The moment even you think about the cake, you get excited. Isn't it? The good feeling pops up. And then all the anticipation, the excitement, and you've got to get it in the mouth. We know it doesn't belong there. We don't keep stuffing in our ear. We know which hole it fits in. And why? Think about this. It's really comical. Why are we doing all the bother of getting a cake and making it and putting icing on it and then put it in the mouth and chew it? Why? Because it's our only way to get pleasure. Can you imagine being like a subconscious? We have to sit there and still get pleasure. And they've got pleasure the whole time. They don't need to go meditate to get pleasure anymore. They've done it. They've got it. They've accomplished it. Their minds are in bliss. When he says something like Lama Zopa, he's like hilariously funny, absurdly over the top, ridiculously hilarious funny the whole time. You can't believe where he's coming from. From another planet. Because their minds are joyful. His Holiness, why do you think Dalai Lama's laughing all the time? Because his mind is joyful. He doesn't need cake and pornography and boyfriends and meals and houses. I'm not being rude. I know I am being rude. I'm always being rude, but get the point. I'm not being punitive. I'm not being critical. I'm just showing how our minds work because they control their minds and grown their minds to be totally joyful minds, you know. And that's our potential. So the first major stepping stone is concentration. Before that, the first major stepping stone is get some damn renunciation. Have a discipline. Make a decision. Get a timeline. We all need discipline. We all need schedules. And the thing is this, like I started saying before, but I got lost. Every time you eat the cake, it does trigger some pleasure. But every time you say no to attachment, it gives you more pleasure. But remember that. Because you're tasting your potential. When you taste your cake, you're giving your power to the cake, if you're weak and pathetic. But when you taste your own potential, when you practice discipline of saying no to the cake, you taste your potential, and that's much better pleasure. This is a fact. We know it, but we forget. So be reasonable. You can't give it all up overnight. You can't walk off naked, and like Geshe-la Kanchog did. You can't. We're not qualified. So we do what we can. We aim for it. But we have confidence that we can. And we all know the pleasure comes from the discipline. We all know the pleasure comes from keeping it scheduled, doing your practice every day. We know the guilt and the weight on our mind of the laziness and the giving up and can't be bothered, it's too late. We burden ourselves with all these regrets, you know. They say, the lamas all say one of the worst ways to die is to all those unfulfilled promises to yourself, all those unfulfilled things that, you know, the sadness of this regret of a wasted life. They say that's one of the most painful ways to die. One of my nun friends, lovely woman, but she said when she was dying, she said, the wasted life. So that was the tragic part for her. She realized it now. It was too late because she's dying. That's the one that's very hard for us. When we can get some enthusiasm for that, that'll be the wake-up call for us, you know. We're wasting our lives, you know. So don't agonize and then beat yourself up for that. Just notice it and then change. And do a little bit every day. And we all know it progresses. We grow. We get a bit better every day. You know? We know that. And we're all the same. We're all variations of the same thing. And at the same time, definitely rejoice in the good things we're doing. If we don't rejoice in the good things we're doing, if we don't admire ourselves for the efforts we are making, if we don't admire ourselves for the good qualities, we'll get very depressed. So we've got to do both. We've got to be very authentic with ourselves, you know. I mean, the thing is, we call this enthusiasm. This is not beating ourselves up. This is enthusiasm. When you're trying to become the best tennis player, you are ruthless with yourself, but you delight in your progress. You're so happy for the coach to point out your mistake because you want to be the best, and you don't mind all the work. You don't mind all the effort. When it comes to our emotions, we're very sensitive. We get very upset easily, you know. We're not allowed to push ourselves. Well, you've got self-hate. No, we've got self-hate already. We've already got self-hate, but it's following our attachment. So we'll get some self-respect the other way, you know, by pushing ourselves, but being enthusiastic. It's called enthusiasm. And be delighted to push. Nothing wrong with pushing. We get very neurotic about pushing ourselves. Oh, I've got to have a break. I've got to have a weekend off. I've got to have a, you know, I can't push myself. Of course we can, but push with a happy mind. When people come home from the gym after 4 hours puffing and panting, no one criticizes them for making effort. No one has a panic attack and sees them sweating. So stop making an effort. You're pushing yourself. We love pushing ourselves, but not when it comes to emotions. We're like babies, you know. Very funny, that one. You see people training in sport. They push to the limit, and people praise them. But as soon as it comes to emotional and core practice, we call it neurotic. Very silly. I think I need you to ask some questions now. You people, come on. About what I've talked about, anything you like, or anything you like. What's our schedule, Donna, darling, today? 3 hours, right? Have a bit of a break in between.
Yeah.
We started at your 1 o'clock, so at 2:30 we have a break, right?
Yeah.
No?
Yeah.
Or two, whatever you like.
2:30 is good, yeah.
Another 15 minutes. No?
Yeah, then another 15 minutes.
Questions. Come on then. Please, questions. I want your questions. Anything at all?
Nothing in chat yet.
Okay. Anybody got anything to say? Things to ask? You hearing me, Andre? You there, Andre? You can hear me? Andre's not nodding. John, doesn't Andre have sound?
John? He's had trouble with being delayed, Venerable Rubina, so he might hear you in a few seconds.
He's got sound, John, or not?
Yes, I believe he does have sound.
So. Andre, can you hear me? He's not responding.
Okay, I'll message him and see what's going on.
He's not responding at all. Look, I don't know what he's listening to.
Yeah, I'll check in with him.
Please, yes. So I need questions from all you people now. Come on.
I have something.
Where are you?
Susie. I'm Susie.
Go, darling.
It's a clarification, maybe question.
Good.
I'm getting that it's okay to have the feeling, the pleasure of the cake.
Mm-hmm.
It's when you become attached.
That's it. Yeah. The fantasies about it. Precisely. This should be a revelation to us, Susie, when we realize that attachment is not the same as the pleasure, but they come so together and then we conflate them. And then that's why Lama Zopa says, when Buddha says we've got to give up attachment, we say, oh, I've got to give up my happiness. I've got to give up my pleasure. We just misunderstand. Pleasure is just this natural capacity of the mind to feel good. And that's marvelous. We're trying to grow that. That's the point. That's Buddha's whole point. We don't hear it like that. You understand? Yes, exactly right.
Yeah.
Of course, we can see how difficult it is to detachment from the pleasure, because we don't know any other way to get the pleasure. So that's why if we have the bodhisattva path, if we're intelligent, before we shove the cake in mindlessly, we offer it first and create some virtue and plug virtue on top of the attachment. And then that mitigates it. It's skillful means. And then enjoy the cake and offer the pleasure. This is powerful. Mm-hmm. And then we can really learn to relax and enjoy our lives, but with skillful means, adding bodhicitta into it, adding compassion into it, adding in kind of kindness into it. It's very skillful means, you know.
Thank you. And I really got a lot out of when you said you get pleasure when you taste your potential.
Yes, when you go against attachment. Yes. That's right. And it's much better pleasure. We feel good about ourselves.
Yes.
Don't we? We all know that. We all know that, but we forget it. And then we sink into, and then we give our power to the cake and the object, whatever it is, and then we feel bad about ourselves. Everybody feels guilty. You know, this is
I need a big sign. Remember your potential.
Exactly, that's right. Exactly, Susie.
Thank you.
Well done. What else, people?
Well, so Venerable, another student, Susanna, said she doesn't have audio video, but she has a question. How do I take vows? Must I do it in the Buddhist context, or can I do it privately?
Well, of course, you know, you can do whatever you like. Of course you can, your own vows. But all the point is in the Buddhist one, it's a system, right? It's a system, and we relate to the Buddha. So the Buddhist vows are coming from the Buddha. So the way you take the Buddhist vows, I mean, the vows to not kill, not steal, he doesn't own those, but there's a style and a system and a method where you take them from somebody. Like, for example, Lama Zopa has given me permission, for example, to do that. For example, Geshe-la, certainly Geshe-la there, your teacher, you know, a person who's your teacher. So basically thinking of myself, I give that to somebody. I received that from my teacher. They've received it from their teacher. And if you think about it, that's an unbroken chain of human beings, unbroken, right back to the time of the Buddha. So there's a very powerful kind of lineage there. It's like receiving a kind of lineage. It's got a very particular meaning. That's the power of the vows, you know. I mean, I think about it when my mother taught me, let's say she taught me how to make a cake. It's not a joke. It's quite serious. Where did she get that recipe from? Her mummy. Where'd she get it from? Her mummy. So there's got real power. That's real knowledge. And they call that, a person who's got that knowledge is called a knowledge holder. That's real knowledge in a mind. And the lineage is there. My mother, when she was a musician, you could track her teachers unbroken right back to Bach. That's super powerful. So you can take your own vow. Of course you can. Nothing wrong. But there's a particular way in the Buddhist one. That's how they just, I'm saying it this way. And then you plug into those vows and with the Buddha's instructions of what it means and how and why and this and that, you know. That's your decision, sweetheart. And we're doing, you know, people are doing it over Zoom these days. I mean, even His Holiness gave initiation. Rinpoche gave eight Mahayana precepts over Zoom now. So, you know, it's the way the world is. What else? Someone?
Maria has a question.
Yes, ma'am. Hi, darling.
Yeah. I've been wondering since yesterday, no matter how many classes I get, how many books I read about emptiness,
yes.
I cannot apply on my life. On the other hand, bodhicitta, compassion, this is what attracted me to Buddhism.
You're sure you don't apply emptiness? You're really sure you don't?
Let me ask you some questions, Maria.
Let me ask you some questions. Have you ever had a time when you're having beginning to have a bit of an argument with somebody and you catch yourself and you go, oh, just relax, Maria, let it be. Have you ever done that?
Yeah.
You've applied emptiness. Okay. If you put it this way, every time you're rigid and concrete and set in stone and I'm right and you're wrong, that's the opposite to emptiness. Every time you're a bit more spacious, that's applying emptiness. I'm serious now. As His Holiness Dalai Lama said, when somebody asked him how to apply emptiness in daily life, when you remember emptiness is referring to dependent arising, when you're recognizing that emptiness is referring in a conventional sense to how things are interdependent. So when you're very rigid and concrete and stuck, I'm right, she's wrong, that's the rigid ego believing in its own rightness and everybody else is wrong. Can you hear that? And then as you soften, you're more relaxed and spacious. So as His Holiness said, the best way to apply it in daily life is simply see something from another point of view. That's applying dependent arising. That means you're not set in stone, and that's applying emptiness, darling.
Yeah.
Of course you're doing it. You've got to be conscious you're doing it.
Yeah.
Every time you reach out and think of kindness for others, you're practicing the compassion wing. Every time you think of it like this way, checking your own mind, and that's the wisdom wing. So you've got different approaches. You understand?
Yes, I do. Thank you so much.
Good, Maria. Who else?
Katie has a question.
Who?
Katie.
Good, Katie. Go. Where are you? Yes, sweetheart.
Yes. So I want to thank everyone for their grace and patience with me. I'm new. So So this is kind of a basic question. Can I think, in the Buddhist context, can I think of karma as an energy? Like, I keep imagining a wheel that keeps producing energy. How we think of it, or is there a better way?
No, it's interesting, Katie. In a way, it's much more simple.
Okay.
The idea of karma is you program your mind with certain habits. So, you know, I'm joking, but like talking about Robbie and playing the piano. Every time he plays, okay, if you saw Robbie playing the piano, you'd go, oh, what? And if you didn't know about learning, practicing piano, you'd go, wow, Robbie, why are you good at piano? Well, you know the answer. It's very simple. He's been practicing it for 10, 20 years. So in other words, every time he plays it, he gets a bit better at it, doesn't he? Do you agree with that? We have a different set of rules when it comes to love and compassion and anger and killing. But if you see a person naturally angry every day, it's the same reason. It's because they practiced it. If you see a person very loving and compassionate, it's the same reason. It's because they practiced it. So we tend to, what we've got to do is look at what habits are, and try the negative habits and not want to practice them. Why? Because Buddha says everything we think and do and say, it doesn't go astray. We program our mind with that and we keep getting better at it. So who wants to get better at anger and killing and lying and stealing? Nobody. And that goes from life to life. That's all. So it's just habituation of your mind. That's the real meaning of karma, darling. It's very simple. By doing that, we create our own selves. You create the musician you become. It's really obvious. We don't think that when it comes to the person that we are. We think someone else did it. But the Buddha says we come into this life programmed with a bunch of our tendencies. It's our own past practice. We create ourselves is a simple way to put it. Do you understand?
Yes, thank you. That was helpful. Thank you.
Good. Someone else? Anybody?
No other questions in chat?
Nobody. Not a thing. Well, then why don't we have a little break now? It's gone very quickly, I realize that, but we can have a wee break now. Why not? No harm. It feels like a natural break, doesn't it, Donna?
Yes.
30 minutes?
Sounds good.
I'll come back at 10:02, a bit after 10:02. Yeah?
Okay, yeah. That's
all right,
good.
Darling. See you in 30 minutes. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
See you soon.